There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Chers auditeurs,
dear listeners,
bonjour.
Welcome in Comme d'Archie podcast season 3.
Saison 3 dans le monde fascinant des architectes.
And in the architectural projects.
Je suis Anne-Charlotte Deponte, passionnée d'architecture et docteur des universités en histoire de l'archi.
I am one of the spokespersons of Anne-Charlotte, who is a PhD in architecture history.
Merci.
Thank you.
D'être avec moi aujourd'hui.
To be with us today.
Et
and
maintenant.
Now.
Lundi en français, place au talent.
And Wednesday, let's talk projects. In English, of course.
Bienvenue dans Comme d'Archi.
Dear listeners, welcome to the 6th episode of our Comme d'Archi summer series on the theme Short Chronicles and Beautiful Castles. This is Esther on behalf of Anne-Charlotte. Today, let's talk about the vast subject of the Chambord Castle, which we are only partially dealing with because of the time available. So, may the specialists forgive us. Beyond the dense forest, through the woods and the hunting grounds, let us imagine the singular fleur-de-lis roof appearing, a marker of half a millennium. The reputation of the Château de Chambord is not new. For several centuries now, many historians have been studying its architecture. And yet, its authorship remains a mystery. At the end of the 18th century, the archives of the royal building site were dispersed or destroyed, making it impossible to find out who designed it. Neither plans nor original text clearly mention the name of the person who designed one of the most remarkable buildings of the Renaissance. On the other hand, through this unusual building, we can undoubtedly identify the influence of Leonardo da Vinci's work, in the comparison of his sketchbooks and the architectural choices made at Chambord, in the centered plan, the double revolution staircase, the systems of double pit latrines, the ventilation ducts, or the waterproofing of the terraces. The work of François I, the patron of the castle, is stamped with the famous salamander, the monarch's insignia, throughout the building, in bas-relief, in many of the vaults, in a repetitive motif. The salamander is the heraldic animal of the Counts of Angoulême, whose motto is Nutrisco et extinguo, i.e., I feed on the good fire, I extinguish the bad fire. The salamander being a symbol of constancy and integrity. It expresses all the ardor of a young monarch. It is represented more than 800 times at Chambord. However, the king's emblem is not without its nuances. Thibaut Fourier and François Parot, in their research L'enjeu dynastique à travers le décor sculpté de Chambord, Rôle et place de Louise de Savoie, The Dynastic Issue Through the Sculpted Decoration of Chambord, The Role and Place of Louise of Savoie, Thibaut Fourier and François Parot emphasize, and I quote, "The royal emblem is particularly present at Chambord. It is displayed in all its richness. This monument, which might be thought to be dedicated solely to the glory of the king, nevertheless, leaves room for the emblems of other members of the royal family, the Dauphin, the king's mother, and, more unexpectedly, his deceased father-in-law, Louis XII. Chambord thus acquires a dynastic dimension that was unsuspected at first glance. The construction, which began on the king's 25th birthday and continued until his death, reflects his preoccupations, his policies, the image he wanted to promote, and their evolution during the reign. In particular, the concern to assert and strengthen his lineage can be seen. In this context, Louise de Savoie, the king's mother, obviously has her place. Indeed, François I was a great communicator. No doubt he would be delighted in France today, where so many boundaries between disciplines have been abolished, and where communication is at the service of power. Although, yesterday, meaning was magnified, the tools were the bestiary and sculpture. Today, the symbolism is out and welcome the manipulation of images, where fiction and reality become entangled in a loss of meaning. Good luck finding your Greek and Latin. One question. Would coding replace ancient languages? Would it be the only language that makes sense today? What about our soul in all this? What about our culture? Let's talk about culture and come back to François I. Thanks to the Italian campaigns, he discovered the marvels of Italian architecture and the work of Leonardo da Vinci. On his return to France in 1516, after the famous Battle of Marignano, François I invited the polymathic genius to stay at the French court as the king's first painter, architect, and engineer. Construction began in 1519 under François I. It was completed in 1685 under the reign of Louis XIV. The administration of the building site was carried out by the superintendent, who centralized the information and the treasurer made the payments. The technique and coordination on the site was the responsibility of the master mason, a man of the art whose training was done in the field. The architect, as we know him today, did not yet exist. We know that Pierre de Corton, maker of castles and carpenter of all carpentry works, took part in the construction of Chambord. In 1532, he received payment for a wooden model of the keep, a model which has now disappeared, but which was later immortalized in a drawing by André Félibien, historiographer to Louis XIV. Let us return to the building site. To support the weight of the castle, which was built on marshy ground, a system of piles was created. Oak piles over 10 meters long were immersed. This platform supports the foundation walls, which are almost 5 meters high and of almost the same thickness, and which themselves support the visible walls. Most of the building materials came from the region and were transported by barge to the port of Saint-Dié, which was itself located 5 kilometers from the site. Oxen and horse-drawn plough covered the last few kilometers. 215,000 cubic meters of stone were transported in this way between 1527 and 1537. Coming from various quarries, this local stone, made of tuffeau, very calcareous, of light color, is easy to extract but very fragile. Oak floors and frameworks come from the surrounding forest. Anger slate is used for the roofing and the inlays of the decoration imitating marble in the upper part. An exception to the rule is the lead, which comes from England. The graffiti on certain parts of the castle make it possible to establish the chronology of the construction. In 1533, the central part, or keep, was completed, from which the side wings were built. When the wings were built from 1526 onwards, the construction site was accelerated with 1,800 workers, masons, carpenters, and roofers. It represented a space of 156 by 117 meters. The windows were installed in 1535. The internal composition of the dungeon, of Italian inspiration, was unprecedented in France. It has a central Greek cross plan. The four sides of the building open onto large rooms measuring 9 meters wide and 18 meters long. In the center is the monumental double revolving staircase. This grand staircase articulates plans and volumes in a completely new way. It rises at the intersection of four huge galleries with barrel vaults leading to the flats in the corner towers. It opens out into the sky and acts as an inner courtyard. The ramp is organized in a manner similar to that of the Château de Blois, with candelabra-shaped balusters. The supports, with fewer ornaments, are presented as pilasters, ordered as one climbs by allegorical and animal figures. As the visitor climbs the staircase, he embarks on a symbolic journey. They are freed from earthly contingencies to access the celestial village materialized by the terraces. The staircase becomes a political manifesto prefiguring royal absolutism. The cross-shaped room determines the housing quarters in the corners, made up of standardized dwellings. For the first time in France, the flats of a keep are designed according to an identical plan and superimposed on each floor. around the monumental staircase, the four vestibules, each open onto a quarter. Each quarter has two living quarters. One in the corner with a square floor plan, the other in the tower with a circular floor plan. The square flat has 7 rooms, the tower flat 5 rooms. Each flat is self-contained and can be accessed via a double staircase. The entrance halls are accessed by independent staircases. There are 77 staircases in Chambord. The ornamentation of the upper part of the keep and the castle, bristling with fireplaces and stair turrets, evokes the typology of the fortified castle. However, by the time Chambord Castle was built, the traditional forms of medieval architecture were outdated. By the middle of the 15th century, the famous metal cannonball, mentioned in the previous episode on the Château de Forges, had quickly made the fortified castle obsolete. And these medieval reminiscences at Chambord Castle are less the result of a slow evolution than an allegorical evocation of military power. 30 years after the end of the construction of the last fortified castles, the elements that refer to them constitute architectural quotations from a world that was, a priori, a thing of the past in the eyes of François I's contemporaries, that of the fading chivalry, of which the young sovereign, the last Night King, was deeply nostalgic. Like the ancient Italian references or those of the Quattrocento, the facades of Chambord offer a great readability of the plan of the castle from the outside. The living levels are visually separated by a molded band running horizontally across the width of the facade. In the vertical direction, the rhythm is given by flattened pillars, or pilasters, on which the bands seem to rest. The arrangement of these elements form a regular, unchanging Italian-style grid. It is in this grid that the different types of openings are set, which gives the facade its modular aspect. These formal preoccupations were already evident in a number of other Loire Valley residences, Chenonceau, Blois, Azay-le-Rideau, etc. But the geometry of the plan of the Château de Chambord is unique, as it was not constrained by accidents in the terrain or preserved earlier buildings. Chambord inscribes in stone the transition from a defensive world to a world of openness. And it is not by chance, in view of current events in Ukraine, that I have chosen to move in this month of August, before the resumption of September, towards a constructive process of opening up through history. At the time of writing this podcast, I am happy to discover and find an echo in Paul Ardenne's article, Architecture and War, the Perpetual Nuptials, on page 100 of the magazine Archistorm, number 115, of this summer. He records, among other things, and with a machine gun, the architectural resonances of our last planetary conflicts, offering this reading of a military architecture that must be impregnable and better placed than civil architecture, which can only prevail when the power is so territorially and politically extended, without contestation of any kind, that it can dispense with the fortified palace and cease to fortify itself architecturally through its customary buildings. This is the case of the French Renaissance, he says. End of quote. Because, yes, during the first third of the 16th century, French architecture went through a transitional phase, and if the medieval typology remained alive, ideas of decoration inspired by Italian models were copied. Then, while remaining in the French tradition, the architects showed an increased understanding of Italian principles. They adapted them, gradually moving towards their introduction into the language of the national monumental. I doubt that the political scope authorizing the Renaissance architecture evoked by Paul Ardenne is the image of a withdrawal into oneself. Formally, it is proof of the opposite. And, in resonance with Chambord, let us hope that this journey of our contemporary world towards light or lights is not over. That war does not condemn us to the point of leaving little hope for any form of life on Earth, leaving behind it, through the folly of men, only inanimate remains. And yet. We could have gone on and on, for example, about the marvelous terraces at Chambord, the entire décor, its post-François I period, but the time to leave us today has come. To emphasize the notion of openness, let's meet again next week with the work on the Château d'Annette, another example of the French Renaissance whose construction began after Chambord. Dear listeners, thank you for tuning in. Let's meet again next week for a new Summer Comme d'Archie in English. And until then, take care of yourselves. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening. Thanks to Julien Rebourg, sound engineer, who is collaborating with us today. Don't forget to tune in to our previews on Instagram at Comme d'Archie Podcast. If you enjoy this podcast, don't hesitate to promote it by giving it 5 stars and a little comment on Apple Podcasts or on your favorite podcast platform. And above all, subscribe to listen to all of our episodes for free. See you soon, and until then, take care of yourself.